All right, so welcome everybody here today to, we're here with Isaac Silva. He's a socialist activist in Chicago in the United States, supporting the Bernie Sanders campaign. He's also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. And we're here today, so welcome Isaac.
Thanks, Alex.
We're here today to discuss the Bernie Sanders campaign, and I guess the things which are quite striking about it are, the place where I'd like to begin is, the establishment maybe is beginning to shift their tone, given that Bernie Sanders is now clearly in the front-runner status and there's more and more people beginning to think that he actually may win the nomination, or at least it seems more conceivable to some than it might have done previously. But the establishment, I think it's very clear, has made a concerted effort to try and rub Bernie Sanders out of the media coverage, just write him off as a potential candidate. So can you talk about that to start off with? Like, what efforts has the establishment made to try and, you know, not have Bernie Sanders be the nominee? And what comments do you have about that?
Sure. So this is just about maybe just under 1 year since Bernie Sanders announced his campaign for president. This was last spring that he began the second run. And that is, compared to previous presidential elections in the United States, that's an extraordinarily long time to be campaigning. But even so, at that point, there were already several other declared candidates. And so that was the first thing, is there was clearly sort of an approach of throwing every potential Democratic Party presidential candidate at the wall to see if any of them would stick and who would emerge as a sort of anti-Bernie candidate. So at one point over the last summer, there were, I think, over two dozen candidates. So you had everybody from, you know, former Vice President Joe Biden to senators to, random state Democratic Party politicians that basically nobody had ever heard of. And I think that was a real strategy that they had of pushing forward all of these other candidates and encouraging them to run with the hope that it would suck up the air from his campaign and prevent him from developing any kind of momentum and inertia leading into the primaries where we are now. And in fact, that spectacularly backfired and accomplished exactly the opposite thing, which is there was so much sort of noise from all of these other essentially interchangeable establishment candidates that there was a dynamic of every month or two, one candidate would emerge as, you know, people who nobody could even remember who they are anymore were positioned as the front runner or the potential backup front runner in case Joe Biden's campaign hit a road bump all through the past year. And so there were all of these ups and downs. Then we finally got to the primaries under a month ago. And the dynamic of the past couple of months has been sort of a reckoning with that approach, where in fact Bernie Sanders has demonstrated that he had a very solid, cohesive base of support, unlike the other candidates who were sort of a flavor of the month, interchangeable, quote unquote, you know, the moderate or the centrist without any clear ideological appeal or core to their campaign. Sanders has, you know, an army of activists all over the country who are clear about why they're supporting him and ready to contribute funding, contribute volunteer hours, and now that we're in the primaries, get out the vote for him. So that reality really hit the establishment in the face within the new year, when he began to pick up a lot of momentum in the polls. That momentum led into the first couple of primary elections in Iowa and New Hampshire, where the Sanders campaign was far better organized than many of the competitors. And so where we are now is that he has won the popular vote in the first three contests, which is, I believe, unprecedented in the history of presidential elections, not just for the Democratic Party, but for either party. So that was one strategy. The other, as you mentioned, is just a full-on, similar to Corbyn in the UK, it's a full-on media sort of alternating between either not mentioning his existence or, you know, totally trashing one or another aspect of his politics or character or campaign, and it's really been all three of those. So for a long time, you know, there were issues of his age. Of course, he suffered a heart attack in the fall, and that was basically the end of the campaign. There have been routine attacks on his base of supporters, caricaturing them as strictly, you know, young white people. That was really held over from 2016, when that was a bit of a reality. And then we've seen recently sort of red-baiting attacks on his identification with the term socialism, past and current comments he's made, positive about one or another aspect of, say, Cuba or the Soviet Union. So there's been, you know, just a range of attacks that the establishment has had.
And I guess also within the Democratic Party itself, like, I think there's all the questions about the rules at the convention.
Yes.
and you know, I think there's, would you not say it's fair to say that the Democratic Party establishment has, as much as anyone else, been trying to pull out all stops against Bernie?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the Democratic Party is structurally, has structural barriers towards the participation of a left candidate. Actually, one reality this time compared to 2016 is there has been some modification of the primary rules as well as the convention rules. So, for example, in Iowa, where he won thousands more votes than the second place candidate, we know that this time, because there was actually a change of the rules to reveal what the popular vote total was, rather than this arcane sort of algebra that assigns delegates to candidates. So although he got thousands more popular votes, and it ended up that he gets fewer delegates because of the way that happened. And so that sort of threw into question, well, now that we see that this time, perhaps it's always been the case that every time there's been an Iowa caucus in the past, nobody has really known what the popular vote was. Similarly, with the convention itself, all of these primaries are competing for allotment of national delegates to attend the Democratic convention in 4 or 5 months from now. And this is the first year in decades where there have not been, there's going to be a first round of voting just from delegates who are assigned from the popular vote, without consideration of the so-called superdelegates, which were decisive last time. These are elected officials, or essentially party insiders of the Democratic Party, who have a decisive weighted vote. This time, they will be prevented from voting, except in the case of a candidate not reaching 50% of the vote. So even if Sanders gets a plurality of voters, say 40%, and then the rest of the candidates are divided up with 10 to 15% each of delegates, that would then move to a second round of voting where hundreds of superdelegates would get to weigh in. And we actually don't really know what will happen. That's sort of what everyone is wondering about now. At a recent debate, not the most recent one, but last week, there was a debate that ended with a question posed to all of the candidates: what would you do in the case of one candidate getting a plurality but not a majority? And everyone but Sanders said, fudging in one way or another, you know, I would go with allowing the superdelegates to vote. So that makes it clear that the absolute priority for Sanders supporters is trying to win 50% plus one of the delegates at the convention this summer. which remarkably actually seems possible, that the campaign has a lot more momentum and strength than I think anybody expected just a few months ago. So yeah, there's all kinds of structural barriers as well, that's correct.
I guess the point I'm trying to get to is, I guess to work out, what do you think is the extent of the challenge that Bernie Sanders represents to the establishment? I mean, my understanding is that Nancy Pelosi said just the other day that, oh yes, she would be comfortable with Bernie Sanders as the nominee. On the other hand, we have seen this huge campaign against him. How do you see, what would be the significance if Sanders is the nominee and or even the president?
Yes, so this is to be honest, this is a debate that's happening in the U.S. now, I think, at all levels of society, within the left, within the ruling class, within the media, kind of grappling with this question, which nobody had been prepared to think about, especially because things are so much in motion where week to week or even day to day, the chances of that being a reality of Sanders winning the nomination, you know, fluctuates. So everyone's sort of wondering what would happen. I think in many cases, there are multiple aspects of Sanders' campaign that are fundamentally hostile to the leadership of the Democratic Party and the self-conception of the Democratic Party. First, he has rejected any source of funding other than his own grassroots base of working class contributors, and makes it clear that that this is a principled stand against the influence of the capitalist class and various elements of the ruling class in politics. And the sort of Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, as well, have set up their own independent fundraising and campaigning apparatus that is, they're Democrats, but this is separate from the Democratic Party apparatus. So I think that that's one thing. The second is, obviously, his program is something which is directly confrontational with some of the main industries in the United States, primarily the healthcare industry, but also fossil fuels, also the military-industrial complex, and he will sort of rattle this off as part of his standard stump speech, saying this campaign aims to be the worst nightmare of the health insurance company, of the pharmaceutical industry, of the fossil fuel companies, and so forth. So it's a class conflict sort of orientation rather than a class collaboration orientation. And third, alongside the fundraising thing, the sort of get out the vote operation, the type of voters who the Sanders campaign is oriented to, the young workers, people of color, immigrants, and sort of directly contrasted the electoral participation of these sectors to, what has become the traditional Democratic Party orientation towards suburban swing voters, so middle class, voters who are, may vote Republican or Democrat from year to year. That's really been the centerpiece of kind of so-called third way neoliberal Democratic Party electoral operations. So in contrast to that, the Sanders campaign has said, we're focusing on mobilizing people who traditionally do not vote as a entirely different electoral base, and one that has intrinsically confrontational posture towards the kind of economic interests that have run the Democratic Party. So I think that there is a huge contradiction there and a huge conflict there. And where it will go, is really impossible to predict, and it's sort of, I could see there being multiple avenues that the people at the top might be cooking up. One would be obviously if they're able to somehow stop him from getting the nomination and come up with a plan to put forward another person as the candidate without at the same time fracturing the base of the Democratic Party, that would perhaps be their ideal. That seems tricky, if not impossible, to do at this point because of the amount of loyalty that Sanders has with voters. Another option they have, which in my view, the smarter elements in the ruling class may hope for, is say, well, if it's inevitable that he does get the nomination and we're not able to stop that, then maybe we'll let him run and sort of pull a Corbyn and sabotage the campaign actively or passively through not supporting it. He'll lose. They could put forward the message, well, this is what happens when the left is in the driver's seat, and that's why we need to go back to Clinton and the Obama-type candidates. And that's a lot of the messaging that some of the other... That's been a centerpiece of some of the establishment messaging in recent weeks, is Sanders is too dangerous. There's all of these congressional candidates, candidates for Senate and House of Representatives, who see a ticket with Sanders as the top is totally toxic to their chances for being reelected. So this is just going to be suicidal for the Democratic Party and for any opposition to Trump, any opposition to the Senate and congressional Republicans. So those are some of the dynamics at play as far as how they will, how things will play out from here. It really remains to be seen, but I think that those point to some of the key structural cracks in the Democratic Party here. So it's an interesting time because this is a far more ideologically clear and politically clear crisis than there has been in either of the major political parties in quite some time.
So what is the mood among the socialist activists? Are people excited by this juncture?
Yes, so everybody is totally excited. And I think that it has been it's been invigorating and unifying in some ways. I think that this is a moment where activists from many different kinds of campaigns that had been their own individual sectoral campaigns, whether around police violence or environmental issues or immigrant rights, the left wing of the labor movement, and so forth, are all put into relationship with one another under the umbrella of the Sanders campaign. It's been something that has been fairly unifying for the left one sense. There's been variations with that. One reality is that there are some segments of you may say the social movement left that have endorsed Elizabeth Warren. That's been a pretty small minority. And then I think another tension within that overall near consensus behind Sanders has been the degree to which, what type of independent posture or total absorption into the campaign the left should have, whether and how to critique some of his policies that are at odds with the goals of the left and various campaigns and so forth. So it's there is a strategic kind of quandary that we're in, even though I think on the whole it has been it's certainly very, very exciting. One other thing that's extremely inspiring is, especially contrasted with his last run in 2016, there is extremely strong and visible support from all types of immigrant and refugee communities people of color generally. It's been something like a Rainbow Coalition campaign that is quite promising, and that's different than was the case in 2016.
Going back to what you said about the, to what extent people should support him or, I guess, challenge his weaknesses, I think maybe we should address some of those weaknesses, like, because, historically you'd say one of the main vehicles for the ruling class in a situation like this is to try and tame the left in government.
Right.
So that's right. Obviously, that's probably a few steps down the track for them. They probably try the other options you mentioned earlier, but there no doubt will be a whole lot of institutional ways they've got to try and tame him in government. And what are some of the weaknesses that you might think would be fair criticisms of Sanders?
What are some of the weaknesses or criticisms that one might make of Sanders?
Well, yeah, what would be some of the fair criticisms you could make of Sanders?
Well, for one, I think that he, while in context of certainly the past several decades of mainstream candidates, he is far more anti-war and anti-intervention. He's not there are some weaknesses there, he talks openly about, at times there would be cause for the United States to intervene here or there, and he can play somewhat into nationalist politics, rivalry between the United States and China and Russia, and so forth. I think another thing is, while the left, so for example, Democratic Socialists of America took a vote at our last convention that in the case that Sanders does not get the nomination, we would not be supporting any other candidate running as a Democrat. He himself openly pledges that he will, even if it's the billionaire Mike Bloomberg or whomever else. So although he is technically an independent, although he's openly critical of the Democratic Party establishment and the record of the Democratic Party, he does sort of tie his own fate, for some understandable reasons, to the Democratic Party apparatus. I mean, it's definitely the case that the type of resonance and breadth that his campaign has had would it be extremely unlikely were he running a third party candidacy. So, it's a difficult question to grapple with, but that is certainly something that many on the left would take issue with. And then finally, of course, while his self-identification as a socialist opens up tremendous breathing room for the socialist left to talk about capitalism as a system, to put forward socialist solutions, when pressed on what he's talking about as socialism, it's a very mild version of, some types of social democratic programs that you might find in Northern or Western Europe, or even I'm just in the mold of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That's what I'm talking about. So it both opens up possibilities for talking about socialism, and then also in some frustrating ways can kind of redefine socialism as liberalism plus some expanded public programs and redistribution, taxes and things like that. Those are all aspects of reality.
Right. That was the first part of the interview with Isaac Silver. where he went, who is a member of the Democratic Socialist America in Chicago, going through some of the different sort of political aspects of Bernie Sanders' campaign, especially, you know, the questions of his limitations, how he's galvanizing the kind of social movements kind of behind him. Now, the main thing with that interview, though, was it was recorded before Super Tuesday. And I guess to give a bit of commentary following Super Tuesday was... It was actually, in fact, quite a disappointing result for the Bernie campaign.
Yes.
It was precedated by a number of factors. The first factors was all the kind of moderate candidates had essentially pulled out.
Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar.
And then Michael Bloomberg, but he followed. He resigned
after Super Tuesday. But all of them, importantly, all of them endorsed Biden.
Yeah. So all of the basically all the kind of establishment Democrats put their full energy behind Biden, completely uncharismatic kind of figure, and so Biden managed to get a good lead, winning most of the states that were up for grabs. Now, the positive thing is Bernie has won most of the share of delegates from California, which actually takes up, has the equivalent of delegates to up to 3 to 4 states, you would say, or 2 to 3.
Mm.
In fact, over 200 delegates are pretty much up for grabs in that particular seat. And Bernie made a huge, massive lead, which is actually a huge improvement when he ran against Hillary Clinton.
Mm.
Hillary Clinton actually won that particular region in the 2016 primary. So
I think it's important to note in California, the Latino community really, really got behind Bernie. And I think that's one of the reasons why he did really, really well there.
So one of the kind of aspects of Bernie Sanders' campaign is the high support from, you know, working class communities. And in fact, there is also interesting kind of contradiction with Joe Biden's campaign in that he does have a high support base for African Americans. And I would sort of like to make one sort of quick comment. I don't necessarily think it's the case of a section of voters kind of voting against their self-interest. I think it comes from the fact that the Democrats essentially are the party that it co-ops every single social struggle. So the civil rights movement in the 1960s made massive gains for African Americans, and essentially the Democrats co-opted that. And, you know, that co-option has still a strong impact on voters. So there is this statistic that shows that a lot of the old population of African Americans or overwhelmingly voted for Biden, whereas the young population or have overwhelmingly kind of backed Sanders. So that is a sort of factor I think we need to consider before going into sort of the line that, you know, voters are a dumb or silly kind of thing, which I think has been sort of a kind of mainstream kind of left response.
It's a non-nuanced argument that's destructive.
And I think, and ultimately Bernie's campaign is trying to, it is actually a challenge to win people over, especially voters, and it actually falls into the perils of electoral politics because, in a sense, the problem with Bernie's campaign is it's effective at terms of uniting social movements, but it's not necessarily strengthening the political power of these social movements. In fact, only political campaigns and class struggle can empower those campaigns. So that's sort of the limitations of electoral politics, in a sense that you have to appeal to a wide base of voters, which can actually include people that are not necessarily going to be on your side in terms of class-based politics. So yeah, that's a bit of the update on Super Tuesday.
A couple of really quick things. Just in regards to Super Tuesday, firstly, there was a low young voter turnout, which really was to Bernie's detriment. But secondly, in Texas, they closed a lot of the polling booths that were predominantly in Black and Latino communities. And in some instances, people waiting 6 or more hours to vote. And obviously, if you're a working person, you don't have that time to wait around. And so that would definitely be to his detriment and to working class people's detriment in that they couldn't vote in the primaries because they could not get to these polling booths in time.
Although this is also going to be a factor in the presidential elections.
It always is.
It's probably one of, because realistically, one of the elements of of the US election is and how undemocratic it is yeah. rationally based on the base that the Democrats have generally, it shouldn't be out of the question that the Democrats should be able to win every single presidential election. But of course, particular sort of undemocratic things that the Democrats fully back, by the way, because they're not interested in reforming it because it would essentially threaten...
Well, they're not interested in democracy, to be honest.
Yeah. It would essentially threaten their position as one of the two political powers of capital. Now, I'll just play a quick announcement and then we'll move on to our second part of the interview with Isaac Silver, where we'll get to continue some of these questions.
This is Irene Bolger, former Secretary of the Nurses' Federation in Victoria. Throughout the nurses' dispute in 1986 and the waterfront dispute in 1998, 3CR was always there, broadcasting the voices of workers in struggle.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio and we're broadcasting live from the Baeda Chicken Strike here in Melbourne.
We've just seen all of the thousands of nurses walk through to their meeting and people from different unions showing their solidarity.
3CR. Radio for the workers, by the workers, since 1976.
All right, we're going to play the second part of the interview with Isaac Silver, which continues sort of the discussion that we sort of started. This will sort of go up to 8 a.m. and then we'll be starting the activist calendar. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
Yeah, I guess to me, I think you and I are both looking at a revolutionary socialist transformation being the only real solution we've got to the problems of capitalism. And I think that
yes.
I think that is true. Nevertheless, at the same time, the fact of the Bernie Sanders campaign having made such a challenge to a lot of the mainstream capitalist ideas, I think that's a victory just in and of itself. Even all the moderate candidates are being forced to talk left. That's a response to this campaign. But it does leave still open the question, okay, for those of us who do see that there is a need for a revolutionary transformation and not simply just electing moderate socialists to government, how would you say, I guess, well, can you make some comments about how that relates to socialist activists today and the strategy in relation to the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Yeah, so I think that there's both an ideological and a material aspect to that. In other words, there's a question of the ideas and the program that he's putting forward, as well as an aspect of what are the social forces that have united behind the Sanders campaign. And so I think that the second of those is really important, and something that has been really good about this campaign is in fact his slogan, "Not me, us," and that's part of his standard stump speech. He will say, "You know, even when I get elected and I'm in the White House, that will not deliver any of what I'm talking about, unless there is a mass movement of millions of working people." Now, what he's talking, when he defines what that mass movement will look like, it tends to be primarily electoral, and saying, well, we need to turn out the vote here and there and knock out the establishment Democrats and Republicans. But I think that message does resonate with people, and it is something that is about putting the working class into motion, about uniting and putting the working class into motion. So on the whole, I think that this is somewhat of a gamble for the revolutionary left or those who see a certain kind of path towards socialist transformation as requiring not just a break with the Democratic Party, but, you know, a break with the capitalist state apparatus altogether. For me, I think that the reason that's a gamble worth taking is looking at where we were with the starting point, you know, over the past decade or couple of decades, where in fact there has not been a powerful working class movement that is sort of getting sucked up and absorbed into the Democratic Party and directed in electoral reformist directions. But instead, I think that this campaign has had the impact of generating and kind of animating what could become such a movement. So I think that the context is extremely important, and that this isn't, you know, the end point, but this is hopefully the beginning point of something that will play out in the coming years, decade, generation, perhaps. So that's what I say. And it's been a fact, for example, with the rise of DSA, I think a lot of that story had to do with the 2016 Bernie Sanders campaign. And I see this campaign having many strengths relative to that one in terms of the layers of the working class that it has mobilized. And so I think that on balance, this is going to mean positive things for the potential of having a socialist movement in the U.S. rooted in the working class.
Okay. Well, that's. Is there anything else that you want to add before we finish up?
Let's see. Yeah. Well, I can't really think of any. The funny thing about this campaign is, for so long, I sort of returning to where I was at the beginning. Campaigns are longer and longer in the U.S., and so there was this, like, months and months where everybody was debating, you know, the character of the Sanders campaign, and now it's like the wheel has hit the road, and every week there's another primary, which both because of the sort of horse race narrative that happens around elections, they can be, you know, I think that the media amplifies who has momentum, this or that, but there is sort of a reality as well of the election in South Carolina is coming up in a few days here, and depending on how well that goes for Joe Biden relative to Sanders, I think it's likely that Biden could win. It's possible that Sanders could win. If Biden wins with a very strong result, then that could change the dynamic over the coming month. If he wins, period, it's going to be totally, you know, there will be a floodlight kind of attention on that by the media, who will then be pushing Biden, you know, as the presumptive main Sanders challenger. But basically, a lot is a lot's still up in the air, you know, depending on which day you're talking about things, because of how quickly the pace of the election goes. That will likely come to the unexpected strength that Sanders has had in the first few primaries over the past month means that most likely by mid-March there will be much greater clarity about what's going to happen. There's a huge chunk of states that's going to be voting a week from now, and that'll really set the course, and then a few more over March is going to sort of clinch it. I'm not sure if that was really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it still actually raises the question, though, because I mean, even if Sanders does very well on Super Tuesday, and it sort of becomes clear that he is going to win the plurality of the votes, at least, a plurality of delegates, at least, that still doesn't answer the question: will the other candidates kind of recognise that, or will they sort of fight on till the bitter end, trying to sort of get a basically anybody but Sanders type result? It still leaves like these open questions too. And then the other question is, if Sanders rocks up at the convention with a plurality of the votes but not a majority, and then the establishment rejects him as candidate, then that will surely open up a big debate both in the Sanders campaign and in society at large about about what does that mean. And I mean, surely that's a more than plausible scenario. I've heard some people say this will be the death of the Democratic Party if they do that. You almost wonder how many times has the Democratic Party died.
Right. Yeah, I think that the question of when and how to end the Democratic Party is, you know, I don't necessarily think that a total disastrous collapse of the Democratic Party in the absence of some clear plan and infrastructure for an alternative would be possible. You know, I'm in favor of replacing or superseding the Democratic Party with a real challenger, a real working class party that's both electoral but also does other kinds of campaigns. Exactly how to go about doing that is something that is increasingly clear that the left has not thought seriously about in quite some time, because the question has never been posed other than as an abstraction. So, you know, we have sort of experience and a track record with, say, the Ralph Nader campaign in 2000, which politicized many people, including myself. But the sort of social weight of that campaign was minuscule compared to what's going on now. And it didn't actually pose the question of breaking up the Democratic Party, separating its working class base from its funding and decision-making apparatus, or those kinds of things. So I think that's another open question, is we say, you know, there's sort of a formula of, well, the working class needs a party of its own. And I agree with that. Then when we think about, okay, what specifically, other than like having a different name and not having any rich people calling the shots, like what would such a party look like? What would it, you know, how would it be structured? What types of activities would it do? How would we govern our, you know, how would we run our own party? Those are really important questions, and unfortunately, I think that there's not clear answers to them right now. So,
it's very clear with these kinds of things. It's one thing to sort of to put the goal down as a algebraic formula of what we want. It's a completely different thing
to mobilize the social forces that can make it possible.
And yes.
I think that's actually one of the exciting things about the Bernie Sanders campaign, is that it is actually opening up new possibilities. Whatever criticisms you can make and whatever limitations there are, I'm not saying that they don't exist. From this distance, it does seem like the Bernie Sanders campaign has put new possibilities onto the table that weren't there before, and that's the thing which is most important. Potentially, or at least that creates a potential.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that's quite interesting now that we're seeing the actual voting strength that he has in different sectors, it's the way that the vote is polarized generationally and racially within and in terms of income and educational attainment, which are the best, you know, demographic metrics we have as a stand-in for class. It's, you know, although some of his vote total percentages in the contests have been relatively narrow, those are delivered with, you know, super majority votes from Latinos, from young people, from people making under $50,000 a year, and so forth. So, and you know, this is like a really strong, cohesive, rock solid base of support that is exactly within the kind of social and economic sectors, and generationally as well. I mean, that's sort of the most important thing, is that it's recognized by Bernie and by the establishment and the media and everybody, that everybody under 35 years old is, you know, essentially a Bernie Sanders supporter, or one step removed from that. So their calculation of, you know, how do you put this back in the bag, counts on, like, well, there's there's this whole generation that's completely polarized against the, you know, the leadership of their party. So that's going to continue playing out in the coming years.
Well, no doubt there will be different challenges and new things to work out as we go along. And I'm sure the main job at the moment is actually to win as much as possible in this sort of this next period and try and actually secure the nomination. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today. To make a particular plug that if you're able to become a Green F supporter, it's one of the most important ways that you can actually make a difference to our project. So please consider that. And thanks, Isaac, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Alex.
All right.
Take care.
No worries, you too.
Bye.
Thanks.
All right. That was Isaac Silver, the second part of the interview, going through all the sort of different political aspects of the Bernie Sanders campaign. And I guess to give a bit more commentary, just a bit of updates, is another kind of debate that has been kind of happening about Bernie Sanders' campaign, especially in terms of the vote, is... essentially, there has been a bit of an accusation that the other sort of I don't really consider that much of a progressive, but she is sort of has the reputation of being so Elizabeth Warren has been sort of, there's been an argument put out there that she has essentially split the progressive vote and taken a lot of votes away from Bernie Sanders and that she should pull out of the race. Interesting enough, as of 2 hours ago, she has essentially pulled out of the presidential race, but she has sort of not elected to endorse any candidate, which is potentially a bit of a cop-out because you just don't... there is actually probably potentially a lot of deal-making going on between the Democrats right now, especially on the question of who is going to be Joe Biden's president, vice president, because essentially one of the things about being a presidential candidate is that if you get elected, you essentially get to handpick your president, vice president, I mean. And there's all this sort of dealing and wheeling between the Democrats because it's a total, you know, undemocratic party of the capitalists and the rich. And then there's another factor is just reading some of the analysis of the Democratic primaries is essentially... Bernie Sanders will have to get more than 60% of delegates. Otherwise, super delegates will be able to sort of overturn his campaign at a Democratic convention. So that's, just something to be aware of. Now, we're getting on to the Green Left activist calendar. And I guess I'll start by the first event that we have coming up is there's a film screening, Pinkwashing Exposed. Countries like Israel promote themselves as gay-friendly to divert attention from terrible human rights violations, in this case diverting attention from the brutal colonization.